Thanks, Peter. That was really masterful. I have so many questions. I'll just limit myself to one.
Okay.
The obey God rather than men context, obviously, is they're forbidding evangelization, forbidding naming the name of Christ. The English Crown was not doing that. I think we can all agree that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was justified in what he did vis-a-vis Adolf Hitler. So in your study, how do the provisions of the Townsend Duties, the Stamp Act, the acceleration of tensions between 1765 and 1775, at what point, or was there a point, at which George III, not necessarily permanent, George III passed the point of into being unjust and tyrannical?
Okay. Let's go back to your first part of your question. I really wonder if Dietrich Bonhoeffer acted appropriately, because he acted, I think, as an individual saying, I'm going to kill Hitler. I don't know that he had that right. Now, knowing all of the struggle and history in the war, if he'd succeeded, I don't think I'd be all that upset. But the proper way to deal with Hitler was what World War II was all about. It was resisting his authority and calling on people to do it. So I'm going to leave that as an open question. Now, maybe you're right, he was justified if I know the full facts. But I think he took that into his own hands and said, I'm going to try to kill Hitler.
Well, he won the ultimate.
Yeah. Well, the question is, did he act properly with lesser magistrates? Did he do it with a proper authority, or did he just do it as a... So that's the question I would raise. So that's another question for another time, because I'm not an expert in the details. I believe what happened with the colonial context is that, first of all, there was a constitution that was given to each of the colonies. The colonies had rights that were vindicated by the right of the king, recognized by Parliament, and established as separate governments that were self-governing. And in that, they had the right to levy taxes. There was no provision for anyone else to do that. And so people often think, well, the reason the revolution happened is that people were mad they had to pay some more taxes, so they were getting all upset. Well, of course, nobody likes to pay higher taxes. But that's not what happened. They saw their constitution being thrown out the window. And that was the issue that, one, caused it to be unjust, because a constitution is a mutual agreement between parties. Both sides have to agree to its ending. You can't do it unilaterally. Further, the king never spoke up to defend the people's rights in the constitution. Parliament violated it, and the king was silent. How long could that continue? Well, what was good is the Stamp Act got them through their protests to say, well, we're not going to do this. But, you know, there was the Declaratory Act. The Declaratory Act said, you know what? We're going to give you the Stamp Act. We're going to stop it. But I'm reserving my right to do whatever I want to do with taxes to you, whether you like it or not. So, in other words, he took away the offense, but he maintained the egregious principle of saying, I will violate your constitution when I choose. He was already a tyrant at that act. Parliament aided and abetted the violation of the Constitution. They had the right to their own. When I was doing archival research up in Boston, it was wonderful. I came across some early papers, and there was a town hall meeting that had the following on it. We hereby, as the members of this community, vote to tax London the following amount per head. And we shall so issue the right that they must pay us X amount. And, of course, that was ludicrous. But what they said is, we have as much right to tax them as they have to tax us. We laugh at that, but that's the same issue. There was no authority. So the issue was not, oh, no, I've got to pay more taxes. It was, they are discarding the very constitutional right. It was sworn, it was covenanted, and the king was duty-bound to uphold it, and they did it. In fact, when he's backed off and he said, but I'm going to reserve this right, he was maintaining the right to say, I will tear up your constitution on this principle whenever I choose. And by the time you get to the end of the declaration with all the grievances, they say, our courts are closed. They're going to take us from our own place and move us out of our place so we don't have a proper care. All sorts of other principles of government are being removed. In other words, one thing after another was stripping the people of their constitutional rights. I wonder how many of you would be upset right now if suddenly the Bill of Rights was saying, whoosh, that they're gone. We don't care. You no longer have those rights. I hope you'd have the courage to say, we're going to stand up and resist that. You mean I no longer have the right of conscience? You mean I no longer have the right to defend myself? You mean I no longer have a right to have a jury? Well, they were losing their rights. perhaps the most grievous one, which was they were posting regularly military officers in the people's homes to enforce the laws they disagreed with, and you had to take them in. Didn't matter if they were going to take your jobs and your food and maybe even tease or tempt your daughter or your wife. You had to do it. Even the home was violated. That's injustice on its face. So we let the king off the hook that right from the beginning he was supporting constitutional malfeasance, which was his duty. Okay, so that's how I begin to answer it. Okay, yeah. Anybody else? Let's go back here. Hold on, I want to have it recorded, so let's everybody can hear it.
I think everybody can hear it.
No, it's not. Not everybody can record it. Okay, thank you.
You're using a word that I'm not familiar with in addressing the colony's relationship to the king. You're saying constitution.
Yep.
Are you saying there's one document that governs all of the colonies?
No, each proprietary colony or separate colony had its own charter or constitution.
A franchising system from the king to...
Well, the one that I know most about would be the one that I've studied, which is the one that established Pennsylvania under William Penn. And so it's called the Charter of Privileges, and it's fascinating. It begins and ends with a statement that no man can truly be free unless he is free within, and therefore no one will ever be molested for conscience' sake on religious matters in this colony. And he ends it with that, begins and ends with that claim. And it's that particular issue that's so extraordinary that when the English king comes to power and he banishes Roman Catholicism throughout all his realms, the only place where the Mass was legally celebrated was in Philadelphia because of William Penn's constitution, his charter, that said here no one will ever be violated. Not even the king could end it. And so now I'm not a Roman Catholic, but I believe in religious liberty. I thank God that the rights of conscience were protected. And William Penn had that constitution, and it stood against the king. That should have been in every one of the colonies because they all had their own royal charters that had a right for them to sort of self-governance. Okay? Right here. Maybe there's a question?
Well, my question is about the English Civil War, which was, of course, about 100 years before our Civil War, and how after King James and then King Charles, like you talked about the Scottish Covenanters, and they tried to force their own views and all that, the Puritan Parliament fought against the king's army and defeated him, and then accused him of treason against the people. So is that kind of the same idea, the fact that the king, that treason wasn't just against the king anymore, that the king could commit treason against the people now?
Okay. So there's a whole theology behind this. So let me build a theology, and then we'll see how they got there. If you go back into the story of wicked Queen Athaliah and the child king, it's in the Kings. As you read the story, you'll find that as the prophet now brings the new king to bear, the first thing he does, he makes a covenant with the king and with God. And then he puts the king in place and makes a covenant after the queen is overthrown with the people and the king. And so the Puritan forebears, like Samuel Rutherford said, there's a double covenant when government is established. Every king has a duty to be in covenant with God, and every king has a duty to be in covenant with the people. And by the way, the people, because they're believers, are also directly in covenant with God. And so the theory that is developed is that when the king violates his covenant with the people, he is violating his covenant with God. He's a covenant breaker. The people, if they're standing with God, are still in covenant with God. They're not rebels. They now have the duty as God-given subjects to stand against the king. Now, again, I'm going to be quite willing to say that maybe they did not have full grounds for what they did. I'm not an expert in the English Civil War. Maybe they went too far. Maybe they should not have beheaded him. That's a great study in its own right. But the theology and the political science that they got from the scriptures and applied to the case is that the king is not an absolute monarch, that he can do what he wills. And he was exercising authority, forcing people against their conscience to do things they believed were morally wrong. And he was enforcing it. And so he was creating all of this resistance. And of course, the solution at the end of the day was religious liberty, but they hadn't figured that out yet. It took the American story to do it. So that's the theology behind it that was the basis of the Civil War. They felt they had just cause because the king was forcing things against their conscience that they believed were wrong before God. And they said, what do we do? Do we simply violate our conscience and sin? Or do we stand up and say we're going to stop this man who now has become a tyrant? Okay, whether they should have beheaded him or not, I don't know. That's another issue, okay? Yep. Back here.
I may be overlooking the simplicity of this comment, but on page 4, on the bullet 7 of the significant exegetical clues, number 7, the ideal leader is portrayed with his proper conduct. He bears the sword to impose judgment against evil acts. Who defines the evil acts? Is it the biblical definition?
That is the great challenge of a person. So we would hope, and it would be our desire, that a civilization would reflect biblical values. There was a belief going all the way back to the first century that generally there was a sense of what was right and wrong in a general sort of way, that we knew that if you stole from someone, it was not right. That the idea of private property was sort of honored, at least among citizens. Against slaves, no. We can take everything, including your life, put you to work. So what is evil and what is right is going to be defined by a society. And when a Christian engages a society, he hopes that he will bring the core values of the Ten Commandments, for example, to bear in a culture. And that's why in the Western civilization in particular, it was very common to have the Ten Commandments and the courthouse walls, as well as in the church. You'd have the reredos in the church for worship, and then you would have the Ten Commandments that would be right there. So, for example, in the state of Pennsylvania, two things I'll tell you. One, I was involved in the defense of a Ten Commandments plaque that was in the courthouse in Chester County. The Free Thought Society said, we need to take it down. The commissioners, there were two Christians and a Jewish leader, and they said, we're going to defend it. I ended up being brought in as an expert witness in the court. I gave the historical argument. And in the appellate process, we won. And I'm thrilled that the judge said it's because of the historical argument that we were going to keep this Ten Commandments plaque here. So in other words, the culture had defined it. It had been there for decades, and it's still there to this day. I'm very grateful for that. Now, another example of the law being part of the culture leavened by Christians is in the Supreme Court in Harrisburg in their chambers in the state capitol building. Right behind where the justices sit, there's a picture of Moses chiseling the Ten Commandments and the glory of God behind them. In a particular recent, about it's been in the last decade, they took a picture of the court seated there and they airbrushed out the backdrop. They didn't want to be identified with the Ten Commandments anymore. There was such a protest that was there in saying, are you abandoning, that they had to get rid of the picture and redo it. Now, they may repudiate what's back there, but they're still reminded every day when they're in ruling that they are ruling under God. And so as you think about the importance of this idea of God's creating right and wrong, this Pledge of Allegiance that reflects the words of Romans 13, under God, were actually taken from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, where it says that we are a nation under God. It happened as an amendment to the original Declaration, and it was put there under Eisenhower's leadership. Why? Because they said we are now in a great ideological battle between Marxist atheism and historic Americanism, which believes that we are in a theistic world. And so we changed it. And that's why, you know, that was an amended. That's because when you look at it, when you say the pledge, you say, we are one nation under God, indivisible. There's no comma there. The reason that we have that pause is that that's where it was amended. And they used to say it, and they put the phrase in there. Even in our minds, we kind of are reminding ourselves it's not there. Why am I saying all these things? They're indications that evil becomes defined well because of the common grace of a culture that knows who God is, and we begin to influence our society. Slavery was enjoyed for centuries and practiced until Wilberforce said, you know, this is wrong. There's nothing that justifies this. In America, we had slavery, and we know we decided it was wrong, and we shed a lot of blood to try to say it's wrong. Evil is defined ultimately by the values a culture brings into it. So think about this. The word culture, it has the word cult at the beginning. We use it in a very pejorative way, like the aberrant cults that distort Christian theology. It's really a Germanic word that means worship. Culture is the inner worship of your heart turned to the public square. And when we have a group that's large enough to influence society because of values we have in our side, and we turn it to the public square, we define evil by what we cherish. And we look at God, then His rule begins to influence our society. And that's the story of the American culture. It's also the story of what's been going on for the last century, an effort to destroy those values and redefine them. Okay. Question here and then to the front. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
It seems so often I hear or read the term providence rather than naming God. I just wonder why that would be in the documents and letters of the founding fathers.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm not selling my book today, so I feel clear to answer it by appealing to my book. So I didn't bring any copies. But George Washington's Sacred Fire goes through and uses every phrase that I could find of Washington's reference to deity. He has about 90-plus different titles for God. So and then I took those titles and I compared them with the sermons that were in Washington's library. It's hard to believe, but he was a sermon collector. And the great preachers of the day, when you go through it, they had an extraordinary breadth of terminology for deity. And it occurred to me that this is the Baroque era. In other words, when you talk about something, why do you say it the same way every time? Why not describe another facet of who God is? So He's the Creator. He's the first cause. He is providence. He is the Lord. He's the Prince of Glory. Constantly changing the words because it's a title of great honor. So first of all, I think that meant that the word would be used in a number of different ways. Providence became one of the most favored because, one, it did not use God's holy name in a public setting. So you remember how our Jewish friends will not say the name of the I Am. They would be very careful to say Adonai rather than what we would say is Yahweh. In much the same way, in our colonial era, there was a sense you didn't use the sacred name of Jesus in public. You reserved that for worship. It was a sacred name for worship. And so what we find is that in public discourse, when they talk about deity, they would use more generic words referring to one of the divine attributes like providence or creator or Lord. And that was part of the mindset of the culture. So providence, by the way, is viewed as a personal being in Washington's writings. It's not just some abstract principle. He says providence takes care of His children. You know, in other words, He is a person. It's a title of deity used for that. So just one of many Baroque terms used for God. There are four references to deity in the Declaration. Let me refer to those quickly. He is called, we're endowed by our Creator. It talks about the laws of nature and of nature's God. It says, we appeal to the supreme judge of the universe for the rectitude of our intentions. And then finally, it says, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we pledge to one another our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Four references to deity, and they're all different. But they all refer to and I would argue, if I can be so blunt, that they are recognizing that, first of all, God is the Creator. And so when they come to the Constitution, they are framers. They are creating a new government. And so as they develop their government, they have the laws. There's the laws of God. There's our legislature. They set up a judiciary. There's a supreme judge of the world. And then they set up an executive with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. Those three parts of government are reflected in the names of deity in the Declaration. And when you think about that era, if you had asked any of the people in that era, who is the supreme judge of the world? You know who they'd said? It said Jesus Christ. At the end of time, He will separate the nations with the sheep and the goats. All authority has been given to the Son, so you honor the Son even as you honor the Father. He is the judge of all mankind, the Lord of the nations. So I would humbly argue that Jesus is even referred to in our declaration as the supreme judge of the world. But those four names of deity then are picked up in the very structure of our constitutional government. So that's the beginning of an answer. Okay, we had a question here? Okay.
I want to make an assertion, and you might correct me if I'm wrong on how I see this. And also, I have three questions that are all tied together.
Okay.
So the assertion has to do with our culture over many years now and the expression of freedom the expression of separation of church and state. And I take that to mean that any elected official or magistrate must leave any religious views they have at the door outside before they enter into some sort of room of governance, I guess. And so then my question is, what are the roots of this idea? How did it become mainstream? And how do you respond to this concept?
Okay, those are all great questions. So let me begin by saying, I have another book. I'll give it to you free. I'm not even selling this one, okay? It's called Wall of Misconception. Does the separation of church and state mean the separation of God and government? Okay, I think we need to really be clear about this. We do not want, look, I'm a Presbyterian, and I know you're more in the independent tradition. We share a lot, but we are not identical. I want to say to you, I'm glad Presbyterians don't run America. If you ever come to a Presbytery meeting, you'll be glad, okay? It's good that we have a mixture of rulership, and that's a good thing. I want to say that loud and clear. But having said that, okay, I disagree with you deeply that our Constitution requires people to leave their convictions when they enter into government. Okay, all right. Okay, good. Yeah. So basically, this is where Washington is very critical. Washington actually writes this. He says, everything I do as president establishes a precedent. Okay? In other words, people can say, well, Washington did it, so we can do it too. Right? So he was very conscious about his own religious beliefs and the beliefs of others around him. And he constantly makes a point that our Constitution gives you freedom for your beliefs as long as you respect the freedoms of those that are next to you. That you have to have your conscience protected, but you cannot violate the conscience of that one that's next to you. That's his standard position, the protection of conscience. I believe that's what will be codified in the First Amendment, the protection. In fact, when you go through the 20 iterations of what were proposed for the First Amendment, 14 of them use the word conscience. The one that we finally have that says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The 14 of the 20 versions of that mentioned the freedom of conscience. They were trying to say, we got to let this part of our being be safe. Okay. So first of all, I believe there's nothing that requires us to be atheist when we work in government, which is what that argument is. You can be a theist, you can be an atheist. You can be a member of one of the non-traditional religions, you can be a member of another religion altogether. If you do that, you must respect the rights of others in you, around you, that you work with. So that's the heritage of the American tradition. Dominantly, of course, has been the Christian tradition because that's been what most of our heritage is. But it does not mandate, there's no test of religion in the Constitution. But there's no denying of your right to be what you are when you enter into government. So we must protect the right of our conscience, and that is what religious liberty does. Okay? Now, the idea that we cannot bring religion into it has been through the misreading of the First Amendment by making one clause of the First Amendment absolutely dominant and rejecting the second. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. Everybody has tax dollars. That means the government's over everything. That means we're going to make us all secular and have no government of, and so we're going to be atheists. That's the way it is. But the second clause says, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Almost nobody said, wait, I have the right to exercise my religion. You say, well, no, today it is. Well, when you go to Believer's Chapel, close those doors and just sing those hymns or those songs and exegete the scriptures, and that's fine. But when you leave that religion behind. That's called the freedom of worship. That's not what our Bill of Rights says. That's the reducers. They're trying to reduce the message of our free exercise to just what you do on Sunday morning. It's not what it is. It's free exercise. So there's been an attempt to overplay the first clause so that everything is under the government and the government can shut us all down, and to make the second clause mean nothing or as little as possible. That's not what the intent was. We need to say, I will have the free exercise of religion, but so will you. And so the idea was is that we have different opinions and we'll work together to create a society where we have to have differences. We can agree even though we disagree at the deepest level or respect each other's rights. That's the American context. And so I would say there's another reason this is happening. Once you remove the idea of the transcendent law of God, which is the basis of this entire argument, Romans 13 doesn't make the king a god. It makes him the leading authority who's under God, is instituted by God for good. When he ceases to do that, he's losing his authority. Well, you can see why an atheistic system, a progressive secularism, is going to say, get rid of God, because then we are God. We are the final authority. There's nobody over us. In fact, if we can get rid of God, we can go a step further. Let's get rid of the Constitution, because it's hamstringing us. It's slowing us down. If we can get away from these things, we'll have greater freedom and greater power. And if I can say it so boldly, that is the issue that's confronting us. Get rid of God. And God's rule is what creates the whole idea of a higher law, which is what a constitution is. So get rid of God. Well, then now you just got, well, you know, the Constitution, it's just man-made ideas. Those people were just people. They were all slave owners anyway, and they were all selfish capitalists. They're, oh, it's wicked. Let's get rid of it, and let's just live in the moment, and we'll do what's right. Get rid of God, then why have gods from the past to give us words on a paper? George Washington had this extraordinary passage. At the end of a letter, it's about 85 pages long. He was writing it to the first Congress as the first president elected. And he never sent it. I guess they didn't have a Xerox machine to copy it off to give it to all the people. It was almost lost, but it's been recovered. And he says the following. I'm going to try to paraphrase it. I don't have it all down exact. But he said, the blessed religion revealed in the Word of God will remain an eternal monument to show what human beings can do to corrupt the best of institutions. What is he saying? The blessed religion revealed in the Christianity, revealed not just in the Holy Writ, but in the words that come from God. By the way, Jonathan Edwards says no deist ever calls the Bible the Word of God. He calls it the Bible or Scripture. This is the Word of God for Washington. The blessed religion revealed in the Word of God will remain an eternal monument. It's here forever. Heaven and earth will pass away. My Word abides forever. To show what human beings can do in their depravity. Wow, he was the beginning of the Calvinist tulip. He got to the T, right? Human sin colors all of our inmost being. To corrupt the best of institutions. Where does it show? That's the judicial body that condemned Jesus. The High Court of Israel. They were established by divine law, and they crucified the Lord of glory, who had never sinned, who came as the Lord. And they corrupted it. He said, so, I cannot foresee what will happen to the Constitution. I'm no prophet. But he says, it's entirely possible that the day will come when something that was meant for good will be used for evil, that something that was to bring a blessing will bring a curse. He said, let us remember that the words of the Constitution are words written on a piece of paper, and no mound of parchment or wall of words can resist a power-drunk politician aided and abetted by lazy and corrupt electors. Maybe he was a pretty good prophet after all. Now, I've paraphrased it, but that's exactly what he says. He said, I'm so thrilled we have the Constitution. He did more than just about anybody to get that Constitution. He called for the convention. He presided over it. He advocated. Then he's elected under it. And he says, I don't know if it's going to survive. And the reason is what he says in his farewell address. Religion and morality are indispensable supports for our political prosperity. You'll find it said again and again by many of our founders. If we take religion out of the equation, we have no basis to teach moral values. If we don't have moral values, We will not have the ability to obey words on a piece of paper, which is what a constitution is. In the book that I was referring to earlier by Francis Schaeffer, he quotes some of the great historians of Western civilization. And he says, in their analysis, there has never been a civilization that has survived with a moral basis that has removed religion. That human beings, being who we are, we become laws to ourselves if there's not a higher governance. And so what you have just recorded in your questions is the attempt to establish a monolithic statist government that will rule over us, and it does it by getting rid of God and then of the Constitution and finally of all of our rights. I sound like a conspiratorialist, but I can tell you this is written in all of their documents. We need to get rid of God. We need to get rid of religion. We need to get rid of the Constitution. And at the end of the day, we'll get rid of American as we know it. And let's not be deceived. USSR fell, but Marxist thought did not fall. It has penetrated all throughout our culture. And what you've identified there is the modus operandi of Marxist thinkers, trying to destroy the fact that we have a free exercise of religion. So, you know, there's that famous saying of Jesus, you are the salt of the earth and the light of the world, and the salt has lost its saltiness. And what do you expect? We'll be trampled underfoot. Okay, anybody else? I've been long. We're still interested. Okay, right here. Or go ahead, right over here, and then we'll go across.
I think you probably asked the first part of my question, but I'm going to ask, you know, I got a two-part question. So I said, what is the relevance of Romans 13 in light of our Constitution today? And what is the church's role in keeping our republic a republic, or are we running out of time?
Okay, wow, those are great questions. I would like to say the answer to the first question simply. let me try to put it in another context. Many of you know that the word covenant is a very deeply biblical word. We have the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, right? We've read the Bible. We may not know this, but in the Latin language, there are three words for covenant. There's the word pactum, like a pact. There's the word testamentum, like Old Testament, New Testament, last will and testament. It's a form of a covenant, a special kind. And then there's another one called a fidus. And you say, oh, I never heard of that. Well, guess what? You use that word all the time. You just don't know it. So if you take the word fidus and you put it in the plural, it becomes fudera. And if you put an L on the end, federal. You ever pay your federal income taxes? You're supposed to, according to Romans 13, right? So federal means our covenantal government. The Constitution creates a covenant. Okay? The covenant is established because we need to make sure that we know what our duties are to each other. And our founders understood it this way. If God, who is absolutely powerful and absolutely good, bound himself in covenant with his people, said, this is who I am, and this is what I will do for you, my people, and this is what I call for you. If God, who's absolutely perfect, had a covenant and he wrote it down, and he's utterly perfect, a fortiori, how much more fallen, broken, sinful people need to have a written covenant that's written down so we know what we're committing to each other. Romans 13 says there's a God who's above. He's instituted authority. He's put a covenantal structure in place. We need to do the same. They were reflecting that. Did you know the most quoted book by our founders, it's been done by the University of Texas here in this your beloved state, they've looked at every one of the founders' writings, cataloged every one of their quotations and citations. Number one on the list was the Bible, one-third. More important than anything else our founders quoted was the Bible. That's how significant it was. So I would say Romans 13 is the basis of a constitutional government where there's accountability because it limits the power of the person. He has authority over you to do good. And he bears the sword to do this and to punish evil. But what if he doesn't do good and he's using the sword to do bad? You must obey God rather than man. It's constitutionalism. Republican government... there was a logic to our founders. I've hinted at it, but I think it goes something like this. Do you want to be free? Well, if you want to be free, then you need to have a republic. A republic is a limitation of power and definition. But to be free, to have a republic, you need to have a constitution. How do you get a constitution? Because a republic doesn't create itself. Well, to have a constitution that works, you have to have people that are willing to do what it says, so you need morality. Well, how do you get moral people? You need to have ultimate accountability, which is the great tradition of Christianity. You'll be held accountable for every word you say, everything you do. And are we losing it? Yes, we are, very fast. One of the ways some of our political and philosophical leaders have said things like this: truth is whatever your peers will let you get away with. It's been applied to the Constitution means whatever you can get away with. These are serious things, and so there's a stripping away of the authority of the Constitution precisely because of the erosion, the hollowing out of the moral character that Washington said were the pillars of our political prosperity. Okay, another question here. Yep.
So ever since, I think it was 1973, there are those who believe that abortion is murder. What would a resistance look like in line with Romans 13, 1 through 7, in order to, I guess, get the government to obey the Ten Commandments?
Yeah. So let's put it exegetically and politically. Those that believe that life is sacred from conception would do so based on Psalm 139 as one of various passages. It says that you looked upon my unformed substance. David was already viewed as David, even though he was not even formed yet. That's the zygote from the conception. That's a strong argument that life is already present in the womb. Okay, so from a biblical viewpoint, personhood means that you have a right to life and it can only be taken for just cause. What just cause can there possibly be to take the life of an unborn child? There can be none. So it's a violation of a just right to life. Definition is murder. So spiritually, we can see that logic. Now, others would try to argue in different ways. They might say, well, I think the Bible puts life with the first breath or other things. But if you take that passage and say it's from conception, life is sacred. Now, when you come politically, we recognize that our religious values are not uniform in our country. We are under a constitution. And there are many religious principles that we disagree. People would say, I don't believe the Bible. So I want to argue medically. So then the question that we need to ask with the Roe v. Wade decision was a division of life into trimesters. Is there any medical basis? There's none. That was just a convenient way of talking about the spectrum of life. What we know is a biological fact from the moment of conception that's human. If it's left alone, if you let it make a choice, 99.9% of the time it will choose to live and become a human being and be born. So that's the issue. It's a natural argument that says this is where life is. Now, with Christians in culture, since the Supreme Court has said our decision is that this is a decision of a mother, it's not the decision of anyone else. And they decide, mothers decide whether that's a person or not because it's her body. Actually, it's not her body. Has different DNA, different chromosomes, different everything. So it's dependent on her body, but it's not her body. But that's the language they use today. Okay, so whatever it is, that's the right. So the question is, how do we resist if we think it's murder? Well, you have a whole spectrum of options. The most simple and clear is that we are to pray for those in authority over us. Are we praying for the courts and the doctors and the judges and the lawyers and the legislators and the presidents, they will do something. That's one. Number two, we can become proactive. We can be salt. Salt stops decay. We can run for office and try to change it. We can try to become persuasive in argument. We can be journalists and try to write about it. Some of us will have a conscience where we can practice civil disobedience. That's a whole issue where people, and Peter will say, listen, if you're going to be punished, make sure you're being punished for doing good. But be ready that you are going, if you choose to be punished, you must be ready to do it for the right reason. So there are those that say, I'm going to block an abortion carrier's office and stop three women from having abortions today. That's between you and God, and you're going to have to be accountable. If you go to jail, you got to go to jail. Okay. There's some who said, I can do more. I'm going to stop an abortionist by taking and killing him. That's happened too. How can you say you're pro-life when you're killing someone? There's no just basis for doing that. Not with any. Remember, an individual doesn't have the right to resist. We have to go through the process. So I think the long-term approach has been what's happened in the pro-life movement, which is we will use each of our legitimate conscientious rights. We'll help mothers with crisis pregnancy center. We'll teach strongly men and women about abstinence to help stop this issue. We will, in fact, try to bring godly controls over all of these areas so that at least they're more sane. Like right now, shouldn't a doctor have admitting privileges at somewhere if he's going to have a woman who's going to bleed to death and he has no place to go? That's just common decency. That's the case that's before the court right now, right? So there's a limit to what we can do. And those that choose to resist, remember it says when you resist, remember there is judgment. And when you choose to break the law, you need to be ready to obey the consequences that come from it. And conscience is going all the way across those. In my own life, I've chose to protest. I've marched in Washington. I've written articles, so I've done journalism. I've helped with crisis pregnancy centers. I've certainly voted when I can for pro-life. I've encouraged pro-life candidates. I preach sermons on it, but I've never blocked a door. I said, I don't think I have the right to do that, but those that do, I respect their conscience. I certainly would speak against harming anyone that's in that office, that we should use lawful means to end this unlawful thing because it's part of our law. So that's how I would look at the spectrum there. Okay, you back.
For years, I've heard about the influence that the Masons had on crafting the language of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. I don't know much about the Masons, but I was curious if whatever they stood for, was that in any way in tension with what the Presbyterian viewpoint stood for? Was there tension there? Was there disagreement? Or was it a compatible view that was just from a more secular angle, I guess?
Okay, it's a very big question, so you're giving me, that's about a 10-minute answer. Are you ready for this? If all of you need to go, you can go. It's all right, but I'm going to try to answer this fully, okay? Number one, the sources for the Declaration of Independence that were used by Jefferson at the Graff House on what would today be Market Street, they are not distinctively from Masonic sources. We can trace them to congregational ministers up in New England and other documents that some of them are even mentioned in my outline that I gave you today of documents. So it is not a Masonic document. It is rather a collection of classic statements that come from many sources. Okay, and there's an unknown fellow by the name of Reverend Wise, a congregational minister. Some of the most important language that you find in the Declaration are come out of sermons that he preached way back long before the Stamp Act. They were already wrestling with issues of government power. So there's a lot of. So I want to start by saying I disagree with that statement. Okay. Now, having said that, there were Masons that helped shape it. Now, the Masonic order is one that is difficult to identify. Again, Sacred Fire, my book, has a whole chapter on George Washington the Mason. So I'm going to summarize several things in there. First of all, when you go to a Masonic encyclopedia, they will tell us that the Masonic order has different substreams. There are some that are atheistic, some that are deistic, and some that are Christian. I'm going to argue that the kind of the kind of Masons that Washington was exposed to and many of our founders were deeply compatible with the Christianity of the day. Now, that doesn't mean they were great Christians. I don't mean they should be. I will say this. I'm not a Mason, never been a Mason, don't intend to join the Masons. I'm a historian looking at the record. And so I mentioned earlier that George Washington was a sermon collector. And he had a whole series of different sermons published separately, bound together, and in his volume. I found this in the Boston Athenaeum. It says, the Masonic Sermons. And as you go through those, you'll find that they're sermons that were preached in Masonic homes all throughout America, and they are filled with great gospel messages. It would be kind of like a Masonic home in New York saying, Tim Keller, would you come preach on St. John's Day on something from the Bible? Well, you know, if Tim Keller went, you'd hear the gospel. And so it was. So I'm going to give you a couple examples of that. I found these right in Washington's library Masonic sermons preached in a Masonic home in this time. One of them, a guy is preaching and he says, I'm speaking to you Masons today and I want to quote your own bylaws. Apparently he'd gone to the bylaws and it says, no stupid atheist or deist may be a member of our Masonic order because we are Christian Masons. Now, I always quote this, I'm quoting that. I'm not calling any atheists stupid here. Whether they are or not, that's another matter, okay? Okay. But the point is, that is what they said. They said, we're Christians, and we are not deists. We are not atheists. Another one, and I've always enjoyed this one, where he's preaching and he's to a group, another minister, a great minister of the day, and he says, I come to you to preach, and some of you think you're going to get into heaven because you have worn the garments of Martin Luther. You're Lutherans. Some of you think you're going to get into heaven because you've worn the garments of John Calvin. You're Reformed Presbyterians. Some of you think you're going to get into heaven because you've worn a Masonic apron. Well, that's everybody there. And he says, I want you to know, none of these will get you into heaven. If you want to get into heaven, you must be clothed in the righteousness of Jesus Christ, received by faith. I said, man, I can preach that. And I've preached that many a time. So this is right out of a Masonic sermon. Now, so the point is that when you put it all together, maybe the best, there are many things I could say, but to summarize it, many of you know Charles Thompson was the only clerk the Continental Congress ever had. He was a classicist scholar. He was a Presbyterian elder. He's the only man to translate the Septuagint from Greek into English, so a great biblical scholar as well. And there's a letter in his archives that I've had the joy to read. The scholars have shown it. And it says something like this. Hello, I am Grand Master so-and-so from the Masonic Order down here, let's say in Chester, Pennsylvania. He said, we are desperately in need of Christians to join our fraternity. We are losing our Christian testimony. Mr. Thompson, you are an illustrious leader and a well-known Christian. Would you please join and keep our Christian testimony alive? I would argue that our founders were part of the Christian Masonic movement that's recognized by the Masons themselves. It fits the history, it fits the sermons, and there's evidence for it. And Washington, in one of his letters, will say, I know some of you have talked about this nefarious group called the Illuminati that allegedly have invaded the Masonic order. He said, in my time, I haven't been in a Masonic meeting for some years. I've been too busy. I've never met such a person in any of our orders. Whether they exist or not, Washington says, I've never seen one. So that's the evidence. So that leads me to say, can you believe that you could be a Christian, even a minister, and be a Mason? The answer is absolutely yes. The first biographer of Washington was a man named Parson Weems. It's the famous book on George Washington. It's still in print. It's called The Greatest Hagiographer Ever Written. You know, he went around, got all the childhood stories of Washington from all the people in Virginia. That's where I get the cherry tree story, the silver dollar story. He got all those childhood stories, wrote them in there and said, these all got to be true. Well, maybe they're not true. But you know what? He was known as one of the great Christian evangelists. He was the pastor of the Pohick Church where Washington worshiped. He was Washington's pastor. He knew him personally. And you know what? You read the records, they said he was one of the most Christian men of his time. And he also was a leader of the Masonic order in his community. You can't say that if you're a Mason, you can't be a Christian in that era. Whatever you think today, that's a non sequitur. The facts do not support it. Okay? I know we're going long. I'm still ready to go. Do we got more? One last question. How about that? Yeah, anybody
one more
else?
Question.
Are we ready to finish? Okay,
anybody
well, let's
have a
let's.
Question?
No more questions. We've worn. Okay, last one in the back. Okay.
Not a question, but a statement. Benjamin Franklin was quoted in saying that we have a republic constitution if we can keep it. Well, we can see what's going on.
Yeah. So those words were spoken as Franklin was being carried at the end of the Constitutional Convention in a sedan chair by four prisoners from the local jail in Philadelphia. The reason he's being carried, he's the oldest man at the Constitutional Convention. He's suffering with gout and arthritis, and he's hobbling. He can't even walk the three blocks from his house to the Independence Hall. So This is the wife of the mayor of Philadelphia who sees him and comes to him and says, Dr. Franklin, what kind of government have you given us? And he says those extraordinary words, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. They all knew that a republic was a very fragile document. The history of republics in history were always short-lived, and it was their experiment. And that's why he said it's going to come down to the responsibility of the people in the government to sustain this. And so it is. I would like to argue that Christian people, we're the salt of the earth and the light of the world. We are the people that keep the moral sanity of the country. If we don't teach these things and stand with them, the anarchy that will follow, or let's say the totalitarian subjection of all of us, is going to follow. Yeah. And I always love to say this, let us not go into the catacombs again willingly. We have been given a place to speak. Let us speak boldly. And let us teach our children. Let's act faithfully, and hopefully we'll make a difference. And that's why we have a group like the Providence Forum, by the way. So final comments, we need to end it. Okay. I'm going to show you something here as Larry comes up. This is the wood of the last piece of the wood of the last Liberty Tree that came down in the Hurricane Floyd in Annapolis, Maryland. Under this tree, the Sons of Liberty read the Declaration of Independence. This tree came down, I think it's 1999. It was thrown into a landfill. A young man rescued it. And so that wood now has been put to work. Taylor Guitars made over 400 guitars that sold for $9,000 out of wood from this tree. The rest of that wood we've preserved. We're planting Liberty Tree seedlings that come from it all across the country as part of our work. And so I want you to see this because this is an 800-year-old tree, and experts in woodworking look at this wood and they can't identify it. And when you say it's a tulip poplar, they say, oh, no, it can't be. They say, why? Because tulip poplar is always pure white. We say, well, the problem is you've never seen an 800-year-old tulip poplar tree. They don't grow like this anymore. This is a canopy tree of America. This tree was here when Columbus discovered America. It was here through our entire story. And isn't it remarkable that St. John's College, right across from Annapolis, the Naval College, they chopped down the tree and threw it into a landfill. It was basically dead. It's been dug out of a landfill. It's been resurrected. And the only people that care about this story are Christian people. And you know why? Because not only because we believe in resurrection, we believe that liberty is the great gift of Christ. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty with which Christ has made you free. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. The Lord has come to give us the great year of Jubilee, the year of liberty. Proclaim liberty to the captives. That's part of our story. So here's this great First Navy flag, right? An appeal to heaven. That's our first flag. That's Romans 13 understood from the idea that there's a higher law. Okay? Larry, what do you want to say?
Well, let's all give Dr. Loback a standing ovation.
Thank you, sir. I want to thank Larry for the privilege. Thank you.
Also, is this on? Yeah, okay. I just want to thank everybody for coming and make sure there's still some handouts out there if you want to take an extra one home with you, whatever. There's a sign-up list out there. It's primarily if you want a copy of the handout in digital format or want more information about the Providence Forum. Also, as you noticed, that this is being videoed, and we can let you know when and where that will be available for you all to look at it later. I want to thank all of y'all for coming. We're having just kind of an impromptu gathering over at Spring Creek Barbecue. There's a room over there, so any of y'all don't have plans, we can gather over there and discuss some more. And maybe Peter would answer one more question over there. That's probably all he has time to do.
Let me add just a few final things. Remember, it's daylight savings time tomorrow. So if you're coming tomorrow, you'll miss the first lecture unless you adjust your clock. Right? Secondly, I want to thank you for being guinea pigs. I've never given this lecture before. Larry asked me to do it. So he's a member of our board of the Providence Forum. And so please forgive all the flaws, because you're my test run here. I'm trying to figure out how to get this down to a lecture format. So thank you for being kind. And if there's some infelicities in the notes, I haven't even had a chance to edit them carefully yet. So please be gentle in your criticisms, okay? Thank you.
One other thing is on June 5th of this year, we're going to be planting, like Peter was talking about, we're going to plant a Liberty Tree at the Hope Center. So if you want to know about that, you can go to the Providence Forum website, and we'll be updating that, or just if you'll put your name on the list out there, we'll email you, and we'd love to have all of y'all show up out there. So thank you again.